from KQED.
This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. And in 1942, President Franklin Delano Roosevelt signed Executive Order 9066, which authorized the wartime incarceration of Japanese Americans in what he called concentration camps. A few Japanese Americans defied that order, and one of them, Gordon Hirabayashi, broke curfew and refused to go to the camp. He became the face of one of the defining Supreme Court cases of that period, Hirabayashi versus the United States. Approaching the 70th anniversary of the case, we talk to his nephew, Lane Hirabayashi, about his uncle's life and legacy, and they have put together a book, actually, called The Principal's Stand. Welcome to the program, first of all. Good to have you here.
Thank you very much.
Put together the book with Jim Hirabayashi, who was a friend of mine, just recently decedent, head of ethnic studies at San Francisco State. We should mention that Lane Hirabayashi is professor of Asian American studies in chair in Japanese American incarceration under the entire Aratani endowed seat at UCLA. But I'm stumbling over my words here. This is quite a story, actually, that you've told. Let's first of all talk about semantics a little bit, because we found ourselves in this whole Gordian knot about, do you call it a concentration camp, because that evokes in many people's minds Auschwitz and Dachau.
Yeah.
Do you call it an internment camp? No, that's no longer acceptable.
Yeah.
Do you call it a relocation? I mean, there are many ways of sort of approaching what we're talking about here, and many ways to express it. What's actually politically acceptable?
Well, I think that the campaign in the Japanese American community has been the Power of Words campaign. And in essence, it's a movement that eschews U.S. government euphemisms to talk about the incarceration of Japanese Americans during World War II. So if you look at government documents and publications from the day, they tend to speak of relocation. Removal is maybe the harshest word, but evacuation and relocation are the terms generally used in U.S. government publications. Interestingly enough, not internment, but I think inside of the Japanese American community, there's been a very strong feeling that we should not use U.S. government euphemisms to describe what happened. And,
well, concentration camp has a historical legacy before World War II. And as I said, that's the language that was used by Franklin Roosevelt.
Mm-hmm.
But we were talking before we went on the air, and Judy Campbell was saying, camp, that sounds like some place you go for summer, you know. So get into all these kind of strange deconstruction attitudes toward the language. But mm-hmm. let's talk about your uncle's story, because it's an amazing story in many ways. Mm-hmm. Here was a model kid, you know, kid of a great deal of faith, not only in
an Eagle Scout.
An Eagle Scout, right. Faith in religion, faith in his country, faith in his country's constitution. And everybody said, you know, just be quiet and do what you're supposed to do. And he was defiant. He said, this is not right.
Yeah.
And so he stood up for what, I mean, so the title is right on target here, a principled stand, a moral stand,
mm-hmm.
and stuck by his guns.
He did. He did. And I think as Peter Irons wrote in his obituary, those years, 43, 44, 45, were lonely years for Gordon.
You mentioned Peter Irons. He called him 40 years later to say the court vacated the decision. Mm-hmm. And suddenly there's vindication to wait 40 years, four decades for that vindication.
You know, I think it's really amazing. I think that you're absolutely right. Gordon never lost that faith. He had FBI agents pressuring him. He got thrown in jail for his stand. I think he was supremely disappointed when the highest court in the land did not stand up in his defense. But and here's something that you might find interesting is when my father approached me about working on this book with him, of course, I eagerly accepted. I always really enjoyed working with Jim on these projects. But I really expected when I looked at the diary and the letters that I would find someone who was in jail and despondent, maybe a little depressed, thinking about what he took on, you know, the whole U.S. government with its resources and lawyers. But it was never that way. He was really very secure in his reading of the Constitution. He was, I think, morally secure at a spiritual level, that this was a humanistic cause he was engaged in too. And I did not find, somewhat to my surprise, the despair or angst or anything. And in fact, I really felt by the end of it that he actually grew in jail.
Let's lay out, just for listeners, exactly what we're talking about here. I mean, everybody recognizes, of course, that people were taken to these places, camps, whatever you want to call them, concentration camps, but also that there was a tremendous sense of initially trying to control the Japanese Americans, thinking that they were somehow traitors. I mean, curfew, your uncle stood up to that. Then the idea that they should be essentially removed, he stood up to that. So there, we're talking about kind of a twofer here, aren't we?
When the case came up eventually before the Supreme Court, the United States Supreme Court, the justices chose to only hear the curfew part of Gordon's initial lower court conviction. But you're absolutely right. He both resisted the curfew but also refused to be removed. So there were two causes that he was interested in promoting: the injustice of a curfew directed solely at people of Japanese ancestry, and then the idea of total removal from the Western Defense Command zones of people of Japanese ancestry. But he was only really tried and convicted in terms of the Supreme Court's reviewing of the case on curfew.
And here's this trial, and nobody has a translator. He has to translate for his own father at the trial. I mean, some of the circumstances of this are just almost made for
That's a great story.
For a movie picture, what it used to be called during this era, a movie picture. And you came across a lot of this material, got to know your uncle as a young man by the time you were in your 50s. Personnel file, personal file, all of these letters, diary, and so forth make up the book.
Yes. I did not know my uncle very well because he and his family lived in Alberta, in Edmonton, Alberta, and we were down in the San Francisco Bay Area. We were here in San Francisco by the time I was 4 or 5. So we would see each other during summers till I was about 18 because my grandparents, my dad's folks, owned a large rambling nursing home in the Seattle area, and we'd all kind of gather there. But I think my first memories of Gordon were as an older, established, professorial guy. He didn't wear a bow tie around the house, but he was always, you know, pretty sharply groomed and sharply dressed. And we had a very pleasant interaction, but I didn't know that much about him. I didn't know him very well. So the interesting thing was, in working on this project, I started reading, as you say, all the letters, the diaries of the 24-year-old, and felt coming away from the project that I actually knew the 24-year-old. And in casual conversations I've had with my cousins, I wonder if I didn't learn more about that young man than they knew about their own father, because I think people change.
Well, and we should mention that he did have his stalwarts. I mean, the Quakers were behind him. There were lawyers who stood by him.
Absolutely.
And, in fact, he wound up marrying one of those Quakers. But the fascinating part of the story and the appalling part of it is just all of the racism that's embedded in the whole narrative and in the whole story. I mean, you had Chief Justice Stone upholding this, but then you had one judge who was Judge Lloyd Black denying the constitutional challenge, saying Japanese are unbelievably treacherous. I mean, this is the language of a man with a robe on. FBI, this accused Jap. I mean, that language again, Japs. And it's shocking in today's world, but it was pretty much commonplace then.
Yeah, I think there's, I mean, there's just absolutely no doubt that especially the first generation Issei, I think, really kind of inherited the legacy of the Chinese who preceded them and then became the first group, you know, through the Chinese Exclusion Act of 1882, became the first group who was no longer permitted free entry. I think that at the same time, though, it's important to remember the support of the Religious Society of Friends, or the Quakers, because I don't think my uncle could have gotten as far as he did with the court cases without their support. Clearly, their visits to him, even in jail, were something that uplifted his spirits. He read a surprising amount of religiously oriented material in jail. That was something I really learned, because Gordon wasn't the kind of guy to quote the Bible or talk about Jesus. Not that kind of person at all.
And so was anchored in Christian faith, though. I mean,
absolutely. And that was one of the real revelations for me, was to see the deeply spiritual nature of his resistance. Not a hostile defiance, but I think a defiance that was rooted in his faith and also his belief in the Constitution. So those things struck me very forcibly. Again, by the end of the project, when I stepped back and looked at it, I said, gee, I really learned something about this guy who, again, like I said, didn't quote the Bible and, to my remembrance, never talked to me really about religion.
One of his statements, compromises are destructive, made me think, that could be taken, to the extreme ideologically, obviously, but it made me think of Thoreau, who went to jail for his own moral stance, refusing to pay a poll tax. And this is in some ways analogous to that. And the old story is that when Emerson went to visit him, he said, "What are you doing in here?" And Henry said, "What are you doing out there?" Meaning, how can you not be defiant against something as wrong as this is? We're talking, by the way, if you just joined us, Elaine Hirabayashi, who is professor of Asian American Studies and department chair at UCLA and nephew of Gordon Hirabayashi, contributor to the book A Principled Stand, the story of Hirabayashi versus the United States. And it is quite a story. It's also a story that that is remarkable in the sense of a young man, a 24-year-old man, standing up not only against the United States, really, but believing in the United States at the same time that he's standing up for constitutional beliefs, and also to some extent standing up against his own community, because there are so many, including in his own family, who don't do this. You know, you're just going to get in trouble, and he did. You're going to bring disgrace to us, all those kinds of things.
A lot of pressure from the community side. Gordon said that even tougher than the FBI agents, though, were his mom, who really pleaded with him not to do this, that the family would be broken up, they had no idea what was going to happen to Gordon in terms of a punishment, jail, deportation. They might never see each other again. And I think Gordon recounts that, her tears were the toughest, the toughest of all in terms of, but he felt very strongly and explained this to my grandmother. And I think that shortly thereafter, though, she recognized his principled stand and, told him that they were going to the family stuck by him.
The Japanese American Citizens League wouldn't support him.
No, I think that they were at the time advocating cooperation and accommodation to the federal government. And I came across files in the National Archive that indicated that one of the key JACL leaders, Mike Masaoka, was very much against Gordon's principled stand. And also, I might add, the stands of folks like—
I was going to mention Fred Korematsu and others who took
Fred Korematsu. The JACL thought that these legal challenges were only going to get the community into more hot water as far as hostility, and they didn't want that.
And you have said publicly you think there are parallels of your uncle's story to the treatment of Muslims after 9/11.
Well, it's very scary because we do not have all the details in regard to Justice Department actions right after 9/11. But what I was hearing from legal friends of mine were that approximately 2,000 folks of Middle Eastern ancestry and in terms of Muslim faith were picked up and held, and in some cases apparently held without access to legal counsel and not even letting immediate family know that these persons had been picked up and were incarcerated. And I think where the parallel is very scary, I think, to many of us in the Japanese American community is right after Pearl Harbor, approximately 1,800 primarily Issei or first-generation immigrants, along with Kibe That would be people born in the United States, second-generation Japanese Americans, but sent back to Japan for socialization and education. About 1,800 of those people were picked up by the FBI immediately after Pearl Harbor. And then after the smoke cleared and the war was over, not one person of Japanese ancestry was successfully tried and convicted of sabotage and espionage.
A lot of people don't know there was a whole Japanese regiment, in fact, in the army fighting in the world in the Second World War, 442nd.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, you've also made the distinction, which is an important one, between generations, between the Issei and the Nisei.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I mean, there were very different values. The immigrants hadn't felt entirely accepted, obviously, but their children also didn't feel accepted in different ways. And here was Gordon, who felt, I'm an American. I'm an American citizen, and you know,
very strongly. I mean, there's no doubt throughout his diary and correspondence that he felt like he was an American, and in that sense, he was. But I think it's very interesting.
So were all the Japanese 110,000 of them that were sent.
Well, you know, I think the
many of them, yeah.
Absolutely, the generational struggle for the Issei was to try and get access to naturalization. Because before 1952 and the McCarran-Walter Act, they couldn't become naturalized U.S. citizens. So a lot of their thrust in terms of making their way in the society was to try to get access to naturalization rights. And they even mounted the Ozawa case. I think that was ruled in 1922 and lost. And so they were not able to get or to become U.S. citizens, you know, before the Second World War. For Gordon and his generation, born in the United States, of course, they were U.S. citizens. But I think their struggle was, as racial minorities, to get their rights as U.S. citizens recognized. And I think that's where Gordon's stand in this was really reflective, I think, of the broader concerns of the second generation.
No, again, our guest is Lane Hirabayashi, and along with his dad, the late Jim Hirabayashi, have put a book out called A Principled Stand, the story of Hirabayashi versus the United States, Gordon Hirabayashi, Lane's uncle, and Jim Hirabayashi's brother. You are welcome to join us if you have questions or comments. If you'd like to lend your voice to this conversation, we certainly would like to hear from you, and particularly perhaps those of you in the Japanese-American community who have some thoughts that you'd like to express. But anybody who would like to join us with questions or comments is certainly warmly welcome. Our toll-free number is available. It's 866-733-6786, and you can join us now. Again, that number for your calls, whether you're listening on radio, internet, or a Sirius satellite, is 866-733-6786. You're also welcome to email us. Our email address, forum@kqed.org, or post any questions or comments you have right onto our website, kqed.org/forum, and click on this segment, Lane.
I wanted to say very quickly, Michael, that the Quakers were true friends of the Japanese-American community in their moment of crisis. But I'll also point out that the U.S. Attorney General Francis Biddle was against mass removal, mass incarceration, because I believe that he felt it was unconstitutional. And also, ironically, J. Edgar Hoover, then the head of the FBI, was also initially against mass removal. Now, that's interesting because Hoover's argument, as far as I understand it, was that all of the dangerous Japanese Americans in the community had been swept up by the Justice Department right after Pearl Harbor. And so he felt that, you know, the worst element was removed and there was no real need to remove everyone else.
He was also probably too busy concentrating his bigotry on African Americans, which is where, I mean, Hoover was so notoriously racist. Again, we're talking about the fact that in 1942, President Franklin Roosevelt signed Executive Order 9066, which authorized wartime incarceration of Japanese Americans in what actually President Roosevelt called concentration camps. And a few of those Japanese Americans defied that order, and one of them, Gordon Hirabayashi, broke curfew, refused to go to the camp. He became the face of one of the defining Supreme Court cases of that period, Hirabayashi versus the United States. Approaching the 70th anniversary of the case, we're talking with his nephew, Lane Hirabayashi, about his uncle's life and legacy. And again, you are welcome to join us. Toll-free, 866-733-6786, or by email, forum@kqed.org, or on our website, kqed.org/forum, and click on this segment. You can also, of course, go to our Facebook page or tweet us. Our Twitter handle's @KQED Forum. Let's bring on Neil. Neil, you're on.
Yeah, just a suggestion only. Would prison camps be the most accurate term for the kind of camps that the Japanese Americans were held in, since concentration camps is too loaded to be considered really accurate nowadays?
I guess my commentary would be is if you look in your Webster's for the definition of concentration camp, and I think as Michael pointed out, it's been a imprisonment technique that has a long and varied history. But the definition of concentration camp revolves around the imprisonment of political prisoners. And when you consider, again, that not one person of Japanese ancestry was tried and successfully convicted after the war or sabotage or espionage, I think there's a sense that the varied penal methods that the government used, these were in fact political prisoners. And I think also the issue of the U.S. government's imprisonment of its own citizens plays in to this in an interesting way. And, you know, I think there is ongoing debate about terminology.
Well, it's like the word survivor. You know, it became so associated with people who made it out of concentration camps in Europe run by the Nazis that when people talked about being a survivor, let's say, of rape or incest or, you know, these kinds of things, it was expanding that word in ways that some people obviously took exception to. I'm wondering why your uncle, being as strongly patriotic as he was and believing in the Constitution, ultimately went to Alberta.
Oh, it wasn't that he rejected the United States. I know he was very disappointed by the Supreme Court ruling, but I think that was a straight-up job kind of issue. He spent some time in the Middle East teaching after he got his PhD in sociology. And then I think when he came back to the University of Washington, he intended to stay in the States. But I think that that job came up in Canada, and that is the direction he went. I just might add that with all due respect to the caller, I think that we don't want to deny, and in terms of the Power of Words campaign, we're not denying anything about the Holocaust or the experience of Jews, communists, homosexuals, and so forth in Europe under the Nazis. I think what we're looking at there is something we'd like to term out as death camps. And I think there are some distinctions. I mean, a concentration camp as a place for imprisonment of political prisoners, a gulag, such as we saw in the Soviet Union, a work camp, you know, where basically people are subject to forced labor, and death camps where people are subject to murder or extermination. Hannah Arendt, the great European philosopher, said that all of these things, all of these three things were death camps, gradiated naturally. But that's an interpretation I think is worth considering.
Let me thank the caller and read some listener comments. One listener writes, kudos to Gordon Hirabayashi for breaking the law and having his name attached to a case. Here the law should have been broken, but it takes the few and the especially brave. Unfortunately, it was like the Dred Scott case, a real low point for the court, and the court knows it. I wonder if we have learned our lesson. When it comes to alleged national security, courts generally defer to the most egregious violations of the Constitution. And we can see this in the past 12 years of torture, renditions, black sites, indefinite detention without charge, mass eavesdropping, etc., and more significantly here in the profiling and targeting of Muslim Americans. And another listener comment, what happened to the Japanese who were interned was shameful on the part of the United States government, but after I saw the violent anti-Muslim backlash in predominantly Muslim parts of some neighborhoods in New York post 9/11, I began to wonder if the World War II internment hadn't saved the lives of Japanese Americans. Given the lynchings and mutilations of Chinese in 19th century San Francisco, God only knows what violence angry Americans would have done as the reports of Japanese military atrocities and high U.S. casualties cycled back to the States. Some perspective. At least the families of Japanese internees were finally given some restitution. No blacks ever got their promised 40 acres and a mule, just emancipation into a country that never gave them or their descendants equal opportunity. Nor did we prosecute the Japanese military for war crimes to the extent we did the Germans. The vivisection studies conducted by the Japanese military on Russian and Chinese civilians were rumored to be the trade-off. It is terrible but true to say But there were far worse places to be during World War II than U.S. so-called internment camps. That theory has been advanced, that Japanese lives were saved. I mean, the hysteria after Pearl Harbor when Roosevelt put out this edict was, and the racism against Japanese Americans was extraordinary.
Yeah, I think that, the commentary from inside the community is often that Roosevelt was a master of PR and that he could have spun this in terms of, you know, approximately 70% of the people that went into the War Relocation Authority camps were U.S. citizens. And it seems outrageous to say that a roundup en masse, the deprivation in terms of freedoms, the loss of property, which was eventually compensated with the Civil Liberties Act of 1988, but only at $20,000 tax-free dollars. I mean, this is America, you know. There's a Constitution, and the majority of people, vast majority of people that went into the camps were second-generation Nisei kids that were 19, 20, or something like that. I don't think... and here's another way to look at it. If they had wanted to, they could have opened the camps and said, "Everyone that feels in danger, step forward, and we'll treat you to Tule Lake or Heart Mountain, very inhospitable, Spartan kind of living conditions." I don't think 120,000 people would have stepped forward.
It's also your considered opinion that some lives were not necessarily protected as a result of the rounding up, or maybe even saved?
Well, you know, who knows? I mean, we could say, okay, Muslims are at risk. Let's just round them all up, Muslim Americans and Middle Eastern. Let's round them all up and put them in camps for their protection. If that were an open invitation and we reopened Tule Lake, Manzanar, and other of these camps, how many people do folks think would actually step forward to be protected? I don't think there'd be that many, to tell you the truth. Even though I totally agree with the statement that after 9/11, a lot of people got hurt. I told my students, you know, don't go, you know, stay off the street because this is going to be a tense
time
month.
Fraught with all kinds of possibilities.
There you go.
Good to have you here. A Principled Stand, the story of Hirabayashi versus the United States, the story of Gordon K. Hirabayashi with James A. Hirabayashi and Lane Rio Hirabayashi. Appreciate your being with us.
I appreciate the time and the opportunity.
And we thank you, our listeners, for being with us. We got another hour of Forum up ahead. We're going to get your suggestions about what to read for the summer as we open up our phone lines and invite you to give us recommendations of summer reads in the hour ahead. Forum is produced our senior editor is Dan Zoll. Our producers are Irene Noguchi and Judy Campbell. And our engagement producer is Amanda Stupai. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation, and by a generous gift from Jan Schrem and Maria Minetti Schrem, who believe that all people deserve access to education, information, and culture for a lifetime of exploration and learning.